wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is 9:02. And on Monday, that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, your host for today's show, along with our engineer, Tammy Dean. Well, the mole is the beast that works underground to expose and undermine the rotten foundations that lie underneath the glitzy surface of this society that promises the good life but delivers so much misery. The foundation we are talking about is the power of the very wealthy who own and control capital, and capital is a quantity that must grow by any means necessary, even if it means destroying the planet and impoverishing the rest of us. We'll be talking about some of that impoverishment today. Bill Resnick will be talking with Portland tenant rights activist Margot Black about housing, unaffordable rents, evictions, and homelessness. Book mole Larry Bolden will be here to discuss a newly republished novel from the 1970s, Other Men's Daughters, by Richard Stern. It looks at family life and its breakdowns. Then our field mole, Desiree Helligers, covers the campaign to save Columbia Pool in North Portland. Her piece also examines the broader impacts of budget cuts to Portland parks and recreation, cuts that may well be harbingers of the broader incremental privatization of Portland pools and recreation centers. And I'll conclude the show with some thoughts about unemployment, debt, and deaths of despair, and the direction we need to move to save ourselves. The Old Mole is podcast every week, and you can find this and all our shows on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/oldmole. And you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show should be up in a day or two. And now, here's Bill Resnick with Margot Black to talk about housing.
Hi, Margot Black. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Margot Black is a co-founder, co-chair of the organization Portland Tenants United. And she's an activist, an agitator, organizer, and thinker. She taught math at Lewis and Clark for many years. She keeps up with the research on what's happening to renters and what's happening to the homeless in Portland and around the country. So, Margot, let's start with that. What's happening to renters and why is homelessness so greatly increasing?
Well, what's happening to renters is that the rent is too high and keeps getting higher, and that's happening in pretty much every city in America. It's happening at a frightening rate at, you know, bigger cities and cities that are making the jump from quaint little cities to bigger, you know, metropolises like Portland is. Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis, Denver, all of these cities are seeing enormous rent growth. There's no rent control. Well, Oregon recently got statewide rent control, but in the rest of these cities, there's no rent control because in the late 70s, early 80s, there was nationwide backlash, I guess you could say, against rent control. Of course, it was led by ALEC and conservative movements that essentially successfully managed to get most states in the union to preempt rent control at the state level. So these rents are growing. Wages are stagnant, maybe even decreasing in some sectors after accounting for inflation. They sure aren't going up by double-digit percentage. Medical costs, student loans are becoming a major burden.
So people are getting poorer and rents are getting greater. Mm-hmm. And what happens?
Well, if you can't afford your rent, then where are you going to go? People are doubling up a lot more. They're getting creative. They're living in their cars. They're living in mobile homes. And then a lot of folks are living on the street. Just in the last few months with tenants that I have worked individually with and gone to eviction court with, I've seen a number of tenants whose really their only for lack of a better word, you know, crime or sin or issue, is that they're not making enough money to pay rent where they live. Now, they used to be able to pay rent, but the rent has gone up. And if you're a day late or a dollar short, you get evicted. It's a pretty merciless process. And these are folks who are moving from stable housing into homelessness.
And the cost of that for any human being and for the families is enormous, right? Being precarious in housing, having to move a lot, or just always being threatened by leaving, you start paying more and more and more, right, of your income for housing, try and juggle all of the bills. Mm-hmm. You don't go to doctors or buy things that you may need from pharmacies. Mm-hmm. But still, ultimately, that doesn't do you any good, and you wind up on the streets. Tell us about the cost of precariousness. There's a whole literature on that, actually.
Yeah, it costs a lot of money to be poor, basically. It's a financial cost. There's also a huge psychological
schooling. You've got your kids are always moving around.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a mother and a renter, and I have had kids to shelter since I was 19. Like, I only know trying to be a renter as a mother and trying to keep my kids stable in that. And even at my peak economic situation where I had a salary job, my husband had a salary job, when our rent went up, our margin was so tight that for us, it starts with, well, the kids can't have piano lessons anymore. And now that is certainly not the worst thing in the world to happen. People are making much greater sacrifices than that. But it starts to show how, you know, you can't do piano lessons, you can't do summer camps, you can't do family vacations, you can't do birthday parties. You know, you start to lose that community building family experiences. And then those are all gone. You know, you're living on less food and the car's out of gas and you can't run errands until your paycheck comes in and you can put gas in your car. And your kids notice that and feel that. And then the car breaks down.
Yeah.
And you don't have any money in savings because you've already drained it to pay your monthly expenses, or you never had savings anyway. I'm the generation that, you know, everybody always talked about how your budget should include money going into a savings account, and I have always scratched my head and gone, well, what? I don't have enough money to pay my regular bills. How can I shave off 10% and put it in a savings account? Like, who does that? You know, and it's the same thing with retirement. People talk about how important it is to be saving for retirement right now, or if you have an employer-sponsored retirement plan, don't touch it, keep it until you retire. And myself and others, you know, my age and certainly younger, are saying, who retires? I mean, we just all assume we'll be working until we die. But when you really start to face that housing insecurity, and especially when the Grim Reaper has come and you just can't squeeze blood out of a turnip and you can't pay that rent anymore, and then your kids are transferring schools, it affects family and home life. The stress is palpable. I have a friend who works for the child welfare hotline, and he says they get calls day in and day out about, you know, abuse, child abuse, and it's often correlated to evictions and housing insecurity. And it's because these parents are so stressed.
And for long periods as their fortunes go down. Then they also try and get another job. And then, of course, they're always exhausted. And furthermore, they're not taking care of the kids.
Right.
And the kids are running off. I'm talking to Margot Black, who is a founder and co-chair of Tenants United, and she keeps up with the literature and has herself experienced the grim reaper of rents moving up and up and destroying people's lives. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the homelessness.
Well, the recent study that came out showed that we have 38,000 folks living in homelessness in the Tri-County area,
right,
and 107,000 folks living in housing insecurity or precarity, paying more than 30% of their income in rent. And these numbers are quite a bit higher than we have seen in the past using the federal government's point-in-time count, which I believe the 2018 point-in-time count showed 5,000 people living unsheltered or in the shelter system. And this study broaden the definition. Part of the problem is that the federal government has a very narrow definition. And of course, you know, that can be good for some purposes, but it also can mean that we systematically undercount, which means we systematically underinvest and underestimate the problem.
Something like 1 in 40 or 1 in 50 of people are homeless at some time last year, they found. That's really quite astounding that they're homeless. But then another 4 or 5 people are living precariously. Mm-hmm. Some of them not just above 30%, they're above 60% or 70% of income. Margot, let's now get into why is this happening? What's happened to the housing in the United States that's led to so much precariousness and moving and then homelessness? You know, it used to be that one industrial worker with a union job, minimum wage wouldn't do it, could buy a home, raise kids, own a car, and send their kids at least to a community college. Now, this is sort of, in a much richer country, it's over with. I mean,
it's not possible anymore. Certainly not on a working class job.
That isn't possible, but it's not even 2 working class jobs.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I used to think as like a, you know, in my 20s when I wanted to buy a house, or I thought buying a house was in my future. And of course, you know, imagine being 21, 22, you're not going to go right out and buy a house, right? That's, you know, an enormous investment. You have to come up with so much money to put down, and then the mortgage is so high, and you just don't even you don't really even consider that as being part of your reality until you've saved for a number of years and whatnot. Now I feel that way about just renting an apartment. Just to be able to get your own place with your family or your partner, it feels like buying a house. Like, wow, you can rent an apartment all by yourself? It seems like a really big financial feat. And it's because, strictly by the numbers, housing costs have just gone up exponentially, whereas wages and incomes have just stayed relatively flat or grown at a much smaller rate over the last 50 years. I mean, I guess it's always been an investment of some kind, but it was a very slow investment. When I was a kid, people bought a house and lived there forever, and then the kids would inherit it. And of course, when you would eventually sell it, you would make a profit, but you weren't selling after 5 years and making $100,000. Housing is just, it's become a commodity, and it's become a get-rich-quick scheme. The social contract underlying housing, where, you know, housing is for humans, it's for homes, it's for neighborhoods, it's for communities, that has just stopped being a consideration as it's become more a vehicle for generating wealth.
Right. Well, it's been commodified and financialized. Mm-hmm. And in fact, vast numbers of single-family homes and almost all multiple dwellings are owned by often big corporations, banks, sovereign funds, including Saudi Arabia's, Chinese billionaires and Russian oligarchs. They're all investing in buying buildings and or even just buying apartments, a floor or 2 or 3 in New York, as investments that sometimes they don't even care if they're rented out.
They don't even care, right? I mean, when we talk about rent control, the most popular rebuttal is, well, it's supply and demand, dummy. You know, what we really need to do is build more housing, and that's what will drive rents down, because the problem is the rents are going up because there's not enough housing. Well, that's just not true anymore. I mean, we have all of these vacant units that the rents aren't coming down on them, and nobody's lining up to rent them, and somehow that, you know, pencils out.
It pencils out because you do it as a loss, and anything you pay on a mortgage gets deducted from your rents. After the collapse of the financial industry and mortgages, and so many people were underwater in their mortgages and were being forced out, the banks took over tremendous numbers of apartments and also whole subdivisions.
Oh, yeah. The banks put all these people in bad loans that they couldn't afford, and then foreclosed on them mercilessly after selling their loan 50 times or whatever, and then foreclosed on them, and then came the same rapacious actors who created the foreclosure crisis came in and scooped up all the foreclosed homes,
bought all the homes,
bought them up, and then re-rented them out to everybody who had lost their home. The problem with these, the investment firms, the corporations, the corporate property management companies, you know, they have these very sophisticated algorithms that, you know, they can just to the dollar figure out exactly the max rent that they can charge to minimize the turnover period. They figure out how to exploit every possible
income maximization.
No, like late fees and...
Yes, they add all of that in.
Yeah, there's just all these extra ways they can nickel and dime you, and they have figured out how to maximize that. And the fact that there is a human, a family, a household, a part of a neighborhood, a part of a community paying the price is just completely inconsequential to them.
And then the people who invest in these funds, in these real estate investment funds,
they don't even consider themselves landlords.
They're not landlords. They're just collecting 5, 6, 8, 10% on their investment. Now I think it's going down because there are so many more companies in, they have to pay a little bit more to buy a huge swath of property.
You know, in Oregon, our PERS, our public employee retirement system, invests in Blackstone. I mean, invests in REITs. You know, all of our pensioners are landlords. And it's tough, right? You want to support good public pensions, but should they be investing in these exploitative markets that are creating a rapidly growing homeless population and wealth inequality and impoverishing the 99%?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is, if you believe in the market, yes, that's how it works.
That's what it takes. Yeah, that's, all those folks just need to work harder,
better
jobs, make better choices in life.
Yes. Bill Resnick here for KBOO, talking to Margo Black. She's a co-founder, co-chair of Tenants United. They fight like what? Devils? No, you fight like hell. What do you fight like?
I mean, we speak truth to power. We name our enemies.
There you go.
And, you know, we don't advocate for neoliberal solutions around this. We advocate for systematic solutions and, you know, very strong reforms on the way, like rent control. And
what are your solutions?
We need housing for low income folks. We need housing for folks that are, I have troubles with all of these metrics. I don't like any of them, but we desperately need housing for folks who are, you know, making 0 to 30%.
For folks who are not able to hold a job. Many reasons that could happen to anybody.
Yes.
And do happen to many families, and some support their...
We need housing for people who just basically don't make any money.
Yeah.
Suppose you make minimum wage, and maybe you pay 30% of that minimum wage to your landlord, but then you lose your job. We need housing that when you lose that job or when your income goes down, your rent also goes down. And that's how public housing works, the best form of public housing. Your rent is just a straight up 30% of your income. And if your income goes down, your rent goes down.
I think we need a whole lot more public housing.
We need a whole lot more public housing.
Not like they did it in the old, putting up these things in either out-of-the-way places or industrial areas with fences around them and let the poor people stew in their own juices.
Right. I mean, we need to build it better. But really, the reason that we've seen some of those projects like Cabrini Green in Chicago and other well-known projects fail is you know, building it in undesirable areas and concentrating poverty, but also massive disinvestment after the buildings are built.
Yes.
They don't keep them up. So yeah, we need public housing that isn't essentially designed to show that public housing can't work.
Yeah.
And we need to build
it,
and we need to procure it. We need to take some of our housing inventory, convert it to public housing.
There's a lot of things that could be done. We could tax the excess profits of all of these people who are ripping off the system.
We need a land value tax that will recognize that people are sitting on land and not building on it, or have vacant units that they're not renting out, or that appropriately taxes people who have way too much space.
All of these vacant buildings that are owned by really rich people and they use them like gold. Yes, the whole system now is so unequal.
Ultimately, we need to remove the profit motive from land and housing. Yeah. Question the value of private property rights around land and housing.
One final thing. One of the most interesting sort of initiatives of the last several years was the Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about it for me was it talks about housing. Mm-hmm. There's a paragraph in there that talks about building very zero carbon, very inexpensive, affordable housing for people. That's part of the program. It's a part of the program for keeping a society healthy.
Absolutely.
You can't like have our current housing the way they're doing it.
Right.
These big buildings, enormously expensive, built not for saving energy, but they assume that the people will just heat it the way they always did with oil or something. They want to build it as cheap as they can, and then it looks like luxury because they have a marble kitchen and all the rest of that crap. Why? There's no money in it for the developer, really, to just have a super efficient building. We are really on the wrong track, this country and much of the world. It's going to kill us, actually, unless we do.
It is killing us. We're running out of time to turn it around. And
you're on the front lines of this battle. I'm expecting some big successes in the next year.
Okay.
Good.
Well, I've got a lot of plans.
Yes.
City and state. So.
Good. And at some point, it has to happen.
We really are making progress. The volume on this is being turned way up. I feel like conversations are happening that haven't happened in a long time, at least, if ever. And they're being received well. A lot of these things are starting to get a voice on the national stage and the presidential election. And we just have to be careful about not staying in this triage crisis mode where we're throwing Band-Aids at it and accepting those kind of neoliberal solutions as good enough now. We really have to start talking about the systemic solutions.
That's really interesting, comparing their solutions to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do that in another interview.
Perfect.
This one is finished.
Okay.
Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
That's Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins. Following up on Margot Black's and Bill Resnick's conversation about housing, here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Stay tuned to hear about the threats to public spaces in Portland, in particular the Columbia Pool and other recreational facilities. But right now we're going to hear from Larry Bolden about the novel Other Men's Daughters by Richard Stern. Larry.
Good morning. I'm surprised that I somehow missed Richard Stern's 1973 novel, Other Men's Daughters. Stern is a writer of great power and an almost unbelievable mastery of the language. Like John Williams' novel, Stoner, also written in the 70s, this is in many ways a quiet novel. And again, as in Williams' novel, there is an undercurrent of probably unintentional sexism that runs through it, though I think both Williams and Stern would have denied this. The lead character is almost always referred to as Dr. Merriweather. He's a professor of physiology at Harvard, married to a very clever woman, Sarah, who has given up her own academic career in order to take care of the professor and their three children. Quoting from the book, "Until the day of Merriweather's departure from the house, a month after his divorce, the Merriweather family looked like an ideally tranquil one. Parents and children frequently gathered in the parlor, reading in their favorite roosts." Close quote. A rather staid and somber man, Merriweather would have considered himself the least likely of men to fall in love with a younger woman. Again, quoting from the book, "When he teaches the introductory physiology course, he begins one lecture Today, ladies and gentlemen, we will talk about love. That is to say, the distension of the venous sinuses under signals passed through the third and fourth sacral segments of the spinal cord, along the internal pudendal nerve to the ischiocavernous, and as well the propulsive waves of contraction in the smooth muscle layers of the vas deferens, in seminal vesicles, the prostate, and the striated muscles of the perineum, which lead to the ejection of the semen. Close quote. Not a very romantic view of love. But unlikely as it seems to Meriwether, he becomes quite interested in a young summerer, that is, students not officially admitted to Harvard, but there to take summer courses. Dr. Meriwether spends 5 mornings a week in the lab with his research work, but he also moonlights as a part-time doctor 9 hours a week, and it is in this capacity that he first meets Cynthia Ryder, who comes to him to get a prescription for the pill. Quoting again from the book, Dr. Meriwether's life was surrounded, if not filled, with women. A distant formal husband, a loving, distant father of 2 daughters. As for women lab assistants and graduate students, he was seldom aware of them except as amiable auxiliaries. Many such women felt their position depended on masculine style, which had meant brusqueness, cropped hair, white smocks, low shoes, little or no makeup. Fine with him, no woman was so despised here, that is, in the lab, as the occasional student who strutted her secondary sexual characteristics. Though the women's movement had begun to reach the biology labs, it went slowly, perhaps because there was a greater awareness of the complex spectrum of sexuality, the 100 components of sexual differentia. Close quote. Meriwether sees Cynthia a couple of times on campus, but even when he exchanges a goodbye kiss with her after one such encounter, he's able to preserve his sense of decorum and distance. Quoting, weeks later, she said, I was so surprised. Still, he was kissing her in part for her sake, for therapy, for a common humanity, so he could still feel himself man of principle, man of year, doctor of confused patient, professor to easily enchanted student. Close quote. Cynthia, like his wife Sarah, is a bright and able student in her own right, and she continues with her academic work even as their affair continues and becomes more consuming for them both. Eventually, Meriwether feels obliged to confess his affair to his wife, though only after a magazine article has called attention to their union. Of his wife, quoting from the book, she was being destroyed. This life could not go on. She was not a mat. She was not a maid. She was not going to clear up his mess. She was finished. She didn't need Kate Millett and Germaine Greer for strength. Close quote. While he continues to live in the marriage house, the husband and wife occupy different floors, and Meriwether finds himself quite confused that Sarah wants him gone. The roughly 2/3 of the novel that describes their slow breakup is often humorous, as well as painful. About halfway through the book, I noticed that almost every time Meriwether speaks of his wife Sarah, he mentions her plumpness, her fat face, her shortness, although he always sees this simply as description, no harm intended. As he recalls his past happiness, his contentment, he says, sublimity! What was anything else in life next to it? He owed that to her, fine little stump of a wife, round back, square flanks, no hourglass there. Close quote. A few times early in my reading, I thought Stern might be aware of the sexist tone to the writing, thought perhaps he was making fun of himself and his own character. But upon completion, it seems clear to me that Meriwether is simply mouthing the views of his time, including views that women are not really capable of scientific discovery or discipline. Philip Roth writes a glowing introduction to the book, and I'm not surprised that Roth seems to deeply admire Stern as well as his narrator, Dr. Meriwether. I agree with Roth that the science asides, and even some of what might be called philosophy of literature that are to be found in the novel, are interesting and well thought out. Still, in the end, this is a novel of how easily men take advantage of younger women and or women in subordinate positions, and then convince themselves that they have done nothing wrong. Meriwether is so much more typical than he pretends to be. When I read Stoner, I found myself wanting to hear the story from his wife's perspective, and in this novel, too, I would have been interested to get Sarah's or Cynthia's take on the events, rather than the rather monotone and self-righteous view of Dr. Meriwether. This is an intriguing book that is so well written. I'll leave it up to you readers to decide if it's a satire or simply a novel expressing attitudes of the time. I've been talking about Richard Stern's novel, Other Men's Daughters. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thanks, Larry. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. We turn back now to life in Portland. At the top of the show, Bill Resnick and Margot Black talked about the increasing difficulty of finding low-cost housing here. But we don't just live in our private dwellings, but in public space as well. Is Portland poised to begin privatizing pools, parks, and recreation centers? In our next segment, Field Mole Desiree Helligers talks with union organizers, activists, and community members about the citywide impacts of cuts to Portland and recreation, and about what activists and possibly you yourself are doing to push back against the slated closure of Columbia Pool in North Portland.
At the end of May, the Portland City Council approved a budget that included significant cuts to parks and recreation, cuts that, in the absence of significant community pushback, will result in the closure of Columbia Pool in North Portland, along with subsidized preschool programs housed in rec centers at a number of sites throughout the city. A total of 70 union positions are slated for elimination. Joanne Hardesty cast the single dissenting budget vote. A number of area schools, including Rosa Parks Elementary and Roosevelt High School, regularly practice at Columbia Pool. And even as Zenith Energy has begun transporting tar sands oil through the city for export, and the planet is rapidly approaching the boiling point, many North Portland residents, including low-income residents of the new Columbia Villa, will find far fewer options for cooling off. And in the absence of affordable and accessible swimming lessons, when they do access water, many will be at far higher risk of drowning. By contrast, on August 3rd, the New York Times published an editorial arguing that every New Yorker should have access to swim lessons. The editorial noted that racial discrimination and poverty have limited African Americans' access to pools. The editorial also notes, according to the Centers for Disease Control, Black children drown at almost triple the overall national average. While longtime Portland residents I interviewed recall the days when the pools were free across the board, on Wednesday afternoons during a two-hour free swim period, the pool is filled to capacity. I spoke with users during the free swim period and to parents with children in swimming classes that followed.
Talking about closing the pool, what do you think about that?
That's bad, no. It's not going to be refreshing for like hot summer and stuff.
How far do you come to get here?
Came in 3 minutes. Yeah. Not very far, but my dad has to waste his time and energy because he's working, so.
This is the closest community center swimming pool to our home. My girls do swimming lessons all year round. This is the most diverse pool that we've ever been to. We've gone to Pier Park, we've gone to East Portland, we've to Grant, and this is by far the most diverse.
Yeah, I've lived here 60 years, and I just can't believe they want to close it. Something in this area it's just great, and there's got to be a way, I hope.
What do you think about a protest at City Hall with inflatable pool animals and slip and slide?
Yeah, that's, you got it. I think.
Does that sound fun?
Yeah.
That would be really fun.
You'd come to that protest, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
On July 27th, as residents of the area began gathering for a meeting of the Campaign to Save Columbia Pool, I spoke with Christina Harris, a union organizer with Laborers Local 483, which represents workers at recreation centers throughout the city.
They are skilled, trained people who have years and years of experience leading recreation and doing admin, having gone to school for these things. To cut the staffing is going to have huge detriments. In terms of the community, they're losing out on about 70 people that are teaching classes and running centers and making things go smoothly. And that also includes the preschool teachers that work out of the center, which Selwood was really big for having preschool. That's one of the centers that got proposed to close. They're in the process of trying to purchase it right now through SMILE, the Selwood Moreland Improvement League. Hillside Community Center and Fulton Community Center also got shut down. They had preschool. Mount Scott also offers preschool. Many of the centers offer preschool classes, and they get filled up very, very quickly. They're one of the few affordable options in the city. Columbia Pool in particular is that that's a huge asset for this community. Not only is it providing and teaching people life-saving skills, I think it definitely opens up the door for a world of fun and recreation for your whole life. If you do know how to swim and swim safely, you can do kayaking, windsurfing, diving, you know, I mean, it can...
And connection to the river and the waterways around here too, right? I mean, if you know, you're at greater risk if you're accessing those waterways or wading or doing whatever at the water if you don't know how to swim.
Right. I think economically even you can make that argument. You know, if people are able to do things properly and safely, how much time and money are we saving on first responder services or dealing with health consequences of an inactive community? I mean, that's the one thing that's so wonderful about swimming and water recreation is it doesn't require a ton of equipment and a ton of investment. If you know how to do it, you can jump into a pool or a lake or river.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a huge emphasis on people aging in place now and not having to go into facilities. And it seems as though if there's like silver sneakers classes going on here, a lot of elderly people depend on the center for community, for exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's definitely a quality of life issue. I've talked to some elders who this is the physical activity that they're able to do now. And if they lose that, of course, there's tons of research on, you know, the connection between the mind and the body and community and how those all tie in for long life and vitality. This pool is an investment in the community. And it's an investment we as taxpayers have given ourselves. Something I feel frustrated with is this dynamic where we are again and again and again having to ask for these resources.
I also spoke with Mary Margaret Wheeler Weber, who's president of the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association.
I became chair of the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association recently after Portland Parks proposed closing this pool because it's such an important asset to our community. I was really frustrated that we didn't have any notice or community outreach from Parks and from the city prior to making this decision and putting it out there. One of the things that's really frustrating for us is that the budget documents, the city planners, they all recognize the importance of using an equity lens in their budget making decisions. And yet they're moving forward with a decision to close a resource for wellness and health for some of the most underserved and marginalized communities still here in Portland. Portsmouth is home to New Columbia, which is one of our largest, if not our largest, public housing community. And our neighbors in the community, we all use the pool. We all need access to that. Parks has told us that they will be doing some outreach, but we haven't seen any sign of that yet. There's two parts to what's going on. One is a proposal to close Columbia Pool in July of 2020. The second part is to put a new facility at Charles Jordan Community Center. Both of those actions are things that will need a lot of community input and outreach, either to mitigate the impact of the pool closure or to determine what's the best facility and how can we best serve our community at Charles Jordan. One of the things we've been saying is we're a community that lives between two rivers. We're a peninsula. We know people have drowned out at Kelly Point Park. We know that water safety is really, really important to the communities that live here. And a lot of the communities that live here haven't had equitable access to water safety historically. That includes African Americans, immigrants and refugees, and frankly, people who live in poverty. What we've heard so far right now from the city is we're going to put in a new facility at Charles Jordan. We don't have a plan. We don't have funding. We haven't done any community input. We're looking at 10 months to figure out what's going to happen next. And for us at the Portsmouth Neighborhood Association, one of the most important things is to be engaging the widest and broadest and deepest and most diverse communities here in Portsmouth and the peninsula and beyond who are going to be impacted by that. People come from all over to use this pool. Portland Public Schools swim teams use it. Kids at Rosa Parks use it. Elders use it. People with disabilities come from other places, other pools to use it because of the way it's set up. If we're going to have 5 years, and that's a minimum of 5 years, if you think about a big capital project of like building a pool, that's a minimum of 5 years. And that's what the city's budget office has said. If you think about 5 years of all those communities without a pool, what's the impact going to be like on centers like Matt Dishman, other community pools, other community centers that are already overtaxed and overstressed? And Portsmouth is an area that we don't have that many community centers. This really serves as a place for us to come together. There's also a lot of people who work in these pools. My sister was a lifeguard at Pier Pool and Columbia Pool. And she has said this is one of the things that really helped get her on a good track. She doesn't know what she would have been doing if she hadn't been teaching there. And it was a decent paying job for a high school student. Like ripples in a pond, drops in a pool, the impact of this closure is going to go far. I hope that people in the community will come out and help us in this 10-month campaign to support our community members who use this pool, our friends and neighbors who work there, our children, elders, people with disabilities who use this. We've got 10 months to change the city's decision. People can learn more by visiting SaveColumbiaPool.com.
Right before the meeting began, I spoke with longtime Portland resident Mariah Taylor.
Been in the neighborhood for how long?
Since 1947. I'm a Vanport flood survivor, a community activist and leader and medical provider for the uninsured. There's so many people that I have met at this pool that are handicapped, those who have conditions that would preclude other exercise. Without access to the pool, they would certainly be in an exacerbated condition physically, mentally as well. And there is a community in that pool. We're like family. We look out for each other and we're there to assist each other. And without Columbia, the condition and the status of our health of our community would go down. An isolated group who don't have access to some of the other services and exercise programs that other people have who are affluent and certainly in a better position financially, it's here.
Once again, Christina Harris of Laborers Local 483.
Can't sing the praises of Joanne Hardesty enough. She was a real leader and a real advocate for parks and these public services in general. She had multiple solutions. One thing that she suggested was putting a COLA freeze on city folks that make more than $80,000 a year for a year to try and fund some of these programs. One of her suggestions was to take money from the gang or gun enforcement team. And another suggestion she had was the police, and from the city's own mouth, they're not anticipating being able to fill those positions even into the year 2025 that they have the budget for. So one of her suggestions was not even to take away money from the police budget, but to kind of borrow some of that money right now.
People have asked also, when I've been doing interviews, people have asked, like, why wasn't a ballot initiative run?
That's another great idea. The point is that there were options available. I feel like they weren't delved into or examined in any meaningful way.
I think that goes to the questions of what other private entities kind of have their eyes on the parks, centers, the pools. I mean, what private entities are going to benefit from this while the people lose? Among the many supporters of the campaign to save Columbia Pool is renowned Portland jazz and gospel singer Marilyn Keller.
When I heard the announcement that this was going to happen, it struck me deep in my soul, injustice of it all. Family moved here from New Mexico in the late 1970s, and to see the gentrification that's taken place in these neighborhoods, but not only that, but the destruction of the tradition and the health outcomes that came along with that destruction of the infrastructure. It's heartless, it's cruel, and it lacks morality. Back from the moment when they shut down the Salvation Army pool right there on Killingsworth and Vancouver, it struck me that was not the best way to see better health outcomes for the community. If instead of shutting pools and community centers down, there should be money earmarked to modernize and to build them up and build up the infrastructure and expand it so that more people can go and enjoy blessings and the properties of having a community center in your neighborhood, 5 minutes from your home. Everybody should be able to go 5 minutes and get to a community center or a pool or a gym, some place where they can spend some time during the day in exertive activity that can only be good for them.
Yeah, and I mean, you hear the city sort of talking about health equity and equity as an issue across the board.
When they're sitting here talking about expanding I-5 corridor down by the Rose Garden and through North Portland again, the same community that expired under eminent domain, and it's more of the same. gentrification, removal, not only that, but banning people from coming back into that neighborhood once it's gentrified. I believe that's one of the reasons behind the closure of this pool. They've already gentrified the neighborhood around it, but it's such a tradition for so many families. They come there from all over the city because Columbia Pool has been their origin, their point of relaxation, their point of recreation. And I think that the newly gentrified don't want to see these families in their neighborhood, don't want to see them parking and on the street and walking back to the pool. So they came up with this solution, which was to shut it down and raise it to the ground, probably.
Preschools located in Portland Parks and Recreation Centers are slated to begin closing on September 1st. Number to contact Mayor Ted Wheeler is 503-823-8120. What do you think about a protest at City Hall with inflatable pool animals and slip and slide?
Yeah.
Does that sound fun?
Yeah.
That would be really fun.
You'd come to that protest, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been Desiree Hilligers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Thank you very much, Desiree. And the campaign to save Columbia Pool will be hosting a day-long free concert in Columbia Park on September 28th, beginning at noon. More information coming soon about what the stakes are and how you can help keep Portland parks, pools, and recreation centers public. Well, you are tuned to KBLO in Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I have some comments now about what makes life worth living.
Sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I don't even know the reason why, but I guess I keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just waiting around to die.
In the film Crimes and Misdemeanors, a wise European existentialist, Professor Levy, appears on video reflecting on the difficulties of living well in a universe without God. Here is one clip.
But we must always remember that when we are born, we need a great deal of love in order to persuade us to stay in life. Once we get that love, it usually lasts us. But the universe is a pretty cold place. It's we who invested with our feelings. And under certain conditions, we feel that they think isn't worth it anymore.
What are these conditions in which we feel that life isn't worth it anymore? The conditions in which love dries up. How about a world in which there is no place for us, where we don't matter, where there is nothing we can do that has value? Is this not the world in which so many people now find themselves, the world from which they flee from their lives into a stupor brought on by alcohol and opioids, or escape from life by suicide? As Chloe Wallington writes in a piece called Who Owns Tomorrow, life expectancy in the United States, the richest country in the world, continues to decline. Opioids, alcohol, and guns are easier to get than health care and a steady and meaningful job. With no hope for the future, Americans are dying en masse by drug overdose, liver failure, and suicide. 70,000 more Americans died in 2017 than in 2016. 47,000 of those additional deaths were self-inflicted, 120 souls per day. Over 1.5 million others tried, but did not succeed. Wattlinger was moved to write this piece by the fate of her brother, Rodney. Rodney ran up a large student loan debt going to college, but was unable to finish, which meant he couldn't get a well-paying job. Hounded by collection agents, he worked various jobs for a few months until the creditors caught up with him and started garnishing his wages. Then he would get by for a while selling food at music festivals. His sister writes, "Thousands of people knew and loved him from the jam band circuit. He was an anarchist, but ethically rather than politically. I found these lines in one of his notebooks after he passed away.
Every time you loan a tool to a neighbor, share food with the hungry, or give a ride to a stranger, you are embracing the anarchist ideal. Live it. But he couldn't live it always. The crisis of never finishing college became a source of lifelong shame for Rodney as debt collectors hounded him for money he didn't have. The way they hunted him across the country meant that he was never sitting still for more than 6 months his entire adult life. My brother took his life in April of last year. Rodney left no note, just several empty bottles of vodka. Until a few hours before he died, he had been 2 months sober, trying a keto diet and going for 13-mile runs while working full-time. He was struggling to better himself until the last moment, but came up against more powerful forces. It is not a unique story. Shortly after Rodney's death, a student loan company called my mom to ask about payment of the debt. "He's dead," she replied. The agent offered her condolences but explained that death did not alter the terms of their contract. End of quote. Unemployment, underemployment, uncertain employment, meaningless employment, and debt. These are among the soul killers that are abroad in our land today. Chloe Watlington writes, "Yes, these deaths are deaths of despair, but more precisely, they are capital punishment for those who fall down in a winner-take-all society." Further undermining the conditions in which it is worth staying alive is what Watlington calls the evaporation of public life, the decline in social experiences not organized around pay or profit. Recall Desiree Helliger's piece earlier on The Old Mole Today about the city of Portland closing the Columbia Pool and other rec center activities, as well as cutting daycare at multiple sites that serve low-income people. And as we heard from Bill Resnick and his guest, the threat of eviction and homelessness hangs over the heads of millions, and we can see the results of that every day on the streets of Portland and every other city. Watlington concludes her piece, "People are tired of it all, but find that they have no one to turn to. They are too suspicious of each other, too cynical about the motives lurking behind every attempt at fellow feeling and human connection. To get to the future we need, we are going to have to generate new collective lives out of the wreckage of neoliberal atomization." Well, I think Watlington is somewhat too pessimistic here. Political and social forces are rising up that challenge the rule of obscene wealth and corporate power. Many people are making friends with socialism as a concept and as a movement. Organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, the Bernie Sanders Campaign, Black Lives Matter, tenants' unions, teachers' unions, and many others are venues where people can generate new collective lives out of the wreckage of neoliberal atomization and reestablish fellow feeling and human connection. And beyond finding meaning in their own lives, they are working to bring about that better world that we know in our hearts is possible, a world organized and directed by the goal of a flourishing life, a desirable life on this fragile planet, rather than the meaningless and unsustainable goal of enriching the already rich. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Strong and his band, a song called My Sweet. To me, it evokes the sunnier world in which life on Earth finally finds its groove, and we can see our way beyond the gloomy clouds that now lie before us. And with that, we conclude today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Margot Black and Bill Resnick for their thorough discussion of housing, to Desiree Helligers for recording and arranging the many voices calling for keeping open the Columbia Pool and other recreational spaces, and to Larry Bolden for his review of Other Men's Daughters. Remember that the Campaign to Save Columbia Pool will be hosting a day-long free concert in Columbia Park on September 28th, beginning at noon. Subscribe to the Old Moles podcasts. Check out our webpage on the KBOO website, that's kboo.fm/oldmole, where you can find more information about our guests and topics. Today's show will be available in a day or two. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer today has been Tammy Dean. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Underground Perspective.